Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to God's glory and that of his kingdom. I am very preoccupied, as I think all of us are, by something that has emerged in recent months, slowly in some cases, but inexorably throughout, in response to this, well, I think of it as a biological warfare attack against us by the Chinese Communist Party, namely a growing, inexorable, as I say, tyranny here at home. I think of it as the China model, basically, with all that it has entailed, from the masks, their mandates, and the quarantines, and the lockdowns, through the inadequately tested vaccines and the mandates that they be utilized and any other therapies need not apply, and then not least the enforcement of those mandates by vaccine passports. A woman who has more, I think, presciently anticipated where this would all lead than anybody else, here or anywhere else for that matter, and who has been more forthright, more articulate, and more reasoned in her warnings about them, is, I'm very pleased to say, our first guest. Her name is Dr. Naomi Wolf. She has been, among other things, the author of this new book, The Bodies of Others. We're going to talk with her about it, the new authoritarians, COVID-19, and the war against the human. Just a further word about her background. She has been a public intellectual of great renown for a long time, very much on the left in the past. But some of the things that she has said, some of the positions that she has advocated for, have made her, it seems, persona non grata among her former comrades on the left. But I think Americans across the spectrum, and certainly on this program, really welcome her with open arms and thank her for this very important contribution to some of the most important public policy choices our nation has ever faced. Dr. Wolf, welcome back to Securing America. It's so good to have you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Congratulations on this masterful new work. Let's talk a little bit about this China model. I don't know if you would characterize it that way or not, but it does seem as though most of the things that I just described, which are now to varying degrees here operating in our country, were brought to us by the Chinese Communist Party. Would you agree?
Absolutely. And you and Reggie Littlejohn, as well as my husband, I've got to credit Brian O'Shea, 12 years military intelligence and now an intelligence, like private intelligence guy, persuaded me early on. I thought when I first heard him and you guys say what a threat China was, I thought that that was not credible. I thought you were respectfully exaggerating, or and we were conditioned on the left to really see fear of China as kind of xenophobic and provincial, because so much money, I now realize, was being made by elites on the left and the right, but primarily on the left, by investing in and aligning with China. So also, I guess I could say that I now see the through line of Marxist ideology and doctrine kind of masquerading for the last 35 years as norms and cultural values on the left that I really thought were organic to the left. So that's really shocking. But in terms of the big picture, I absolutely agree with you. I make this case now in The Bodies of Others, and credit you and Ms. Littlejohn, because I do see now that the last 2 years of the pandemic has been exported from China, but also exploited by China in alliance with the World Economic Forum and with big tech jumping on the bandwagon in a way as to create a national security breach, to make war on us, asymmetrical warfare, as General Spalding and others call it, typical of Chinese warfare, CCP warfare, I should say. And I see understood warfare, I beg your pardon. And I see that they have been largely successful. And people, the shocking thing is people remain unaware that there's been a kind of terraforming of our culture intentionally to make it less and less Western, less and less American, less and less about Western values and capitalist values like family and property rights and, you know, Western values, post-Renaissance values, post-Enlightenment values like individual human rights, individual bodily autonomy, and more like seeding CCP style values and norms and cultural change into our own culture.
Yeah. One of the things that you just sort of alluded to there is this effort to sort of turn our country into just another nation, a member of the world order of supranational organizations. And you were very vocal in warning against something that was averted temporarily, I fear, but I think it's a stay of execution rather than a commutation of sentence, through the Biden administration's efforts voluntarily to surrender our sovereignty to the World Health Organization, enabling its director general, I should say, Tedros Ghebreyesus, to basically become the arbiter of what is a public health emergency of international concern and what would be done about it. Talk a little bit about why you were so insistent that that mustn't be allowed and where you think things stand now.
Yeah, I mean, they've really kind of revealed their hand. You know, a year and a half ago, if you said, which I tried to say, you know, this is a global script run by people who are transcending nation states and enacted in such a way as to bypass and dilute nation states, you know, you'd be called a conspiracy theorist, as I often am. But the fact is that they've revealed that that's exactly what they are trying to do. And this treaty, which was, I agree with you, narrowly averted, forestalled, I agree, they're going to sneak it back in one way or another because the record shows, and I trace this in the bodies of others, that that's just exactly what they do and have been doing. This was a treaty that the World Health Organization was trying to get signed by 190 nations and that our own Biden administration proposed amendments to in support of, which is shocking, which would literally create a supranational power for the head of WHO, who is aligned with China and funded by Bill Gates and China as major funders, to declare a public health emergency anywhere in the world and to decide what happens then anywhere in the world under the guise of that public health emergency, removing sovereignty. And we've seen, you know, people could say, well, maybe that's, you know, nice scientists in lab coats who just want what's best for us. Well, we've seen what these people want to do. They want to deploy mercenaries, you know, wherever they want. They want to, you know, we narrowly defeated a regulation, a Board of Health regulation in Washington State that would have allowed a Board of Health agents, HHS agents, to create a quarantine camp, detain members of that state indefinitely if they were exposed to a bloodborne pathogen. And over here in New York State, where I'm sitting talking to you, our governor keeps extending emergency powers based on the emergency of racism now, which I agree racism is very bad, but you know, it's not a reason to suppress our rights, on the contrary. And she also is trying to create powers to detain and quarantine people if they're exposed to a bloodborne pathogen. So
Naomi, hold that thought. I want to come back because this is not the only peculiar pretext for extending emergency powers. We're going to talk about Joe Biden's in a moment. We have to take a short break. We'll be right back with Dr. Naomi Wolf, the author of The Bodies of Others. It's a fabulous best-selling book. You must get it. Stay tuned for more. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The primetime launch last night by the House Select Committee on January 6th showed that it's promoting a false narrative of a government-toppling insurrection, not pursuing the truth. After all, the truth is, there would have been no penetration of the capital had it been on a heightened security status. Instead, somebody directed that it be on a less secure footing than even the normal day-to-day level. Who gave that order? Was it the same person who declined President Trump's authorization to deploy 20,000 National Guardsmen to protect the Capitol? The further question occurs, was the reason for such decisions to set the stage for direct action, perhaps by FBI informants and operatives and those with whom they were working? We're not likely to get answers to these questions from the January 6th committee, at least until it's under new management. This is Frank Gaffney. Welcome back. We're talking with Dr. Naomi Wolf, the author of The Bodies of Others, among a number of other really important works, but this one is hot off the presses, an instant bestseller, I'm happy to say, and well-deserved as such. It is a required read to understand the times we're in and what is being done in the name of public health in particular, to impose really a model of governance that is tyrannical. And I think it's properly described as one we have had handed down to us by the Chinese Communist Party. And that can't be good. Naomi, you were just talking about in your state of New York and in Washington State, executive orders or emergency declarations. I wanted to ask you about the latest extension of the emergency order by Joe Biden at the national level. You pointed out that there's a very peculiar justification. What was that, and what on earth does it mean?
Yeah, thank you. Well, I'll tell you, but before I turn to that, I just wanted to note about the treaty that the goal of these people is to dissolve the nation state. And I've got a chapter in The Bodies of Others about how even though the nation state has its flaws and its shortcomings, and nationalism can be turned to negative uses, a nation state with citizens and borders is the only defense against this kind of tyranny. So we should be incredibly aware by now that these metanational entities declaring public health emergencies have tried to have closed parliaments in Australia, in Britain, driven parliamentary decision-making onto Zoom, whose servers are in China, right? It's like a hack of Western democracies, as Steve Waterhouse, an advisor to the Canadian Parliament, points out. And so that's the effort right now, is to dissolve our sovereignty. So you asked what was the pretext of the latest extension of emergency powers. Most people don't know that we are under emergency powers at a federal level right now. The coup has happened. This is why I keep saying there's a war on us, and it's already taken place. It's not in the future, it's now. So President Biden, for whom I'm embarrassed to say I voted, extended emergency powers based on the public health emergency 8 times. But the last time he did it in an open-ended way, meaning there's no terminus point. This was April of 2022. And this time it wasn't public health because COVID is over, right? Conveniently, because they got a bad memo from a DNC political consultant saying people were sick of it and, you know, midterms are coming. But this time the pretext was, and this is in the declaration of the extension of emergency powers, the stability of Iraq due to issues of stabilization in Iraq. And it's like, what year is this? What war is this? Who's writing his material? So they're not even hiding anymore. And there are 22 states, last I checked, that are still under emergency law. And the reason this is so important, people have to understand, is that when you're under emergency law, things can be done to you. You know, the Constitution is essentially suspended. Things can be done to you, like what we saw with the lockdowns. Your business can be closed. you know, mandated injections that are mRNA, you know, injections that are not approved under normal conditions can be imposed on you. You know, you can be fired from the military. You can be fired from, you know, hospitals. Your children can be kept from school. So emergency powers are extremely dangerous. And under emergency law, you know, borders can be opened. Borders can be open. I worry a lot. Like, I love talking to you, Frank, because you're one of the few people who understands that this is a national security emergency. This is a national security issue. If we've got open borders to the South, and I'm pro legal immigration, I'm the daughter and granddaughter of immigrants, but we've got men flowing in from the South of fighting age from Ukraine and from Afghanistan. We don't know where they're going. We've got mercenaries in Canada who are not identified, and I've had it confirmed that they are actually mercenaries. They're not local police or even local military. You know, and Trudeau, reading from the same script, global script of tyranny, you know, declared martial law. Biden could open that border and flow those men in no time. You know, it may be
even happening now, unbeknownst to us. Yeah. Naomi, listen, one of the things that I just to wrap that part up, and then I want to turn to another very important contribution you've just made. This business about emergency orders, I think your warnings about it have been so trenchant in that once you've surrendered to it, it's very unlikely that you're going to get your freedoms back. And that's what's so alarming about this is, as you say, a DNC consultant's memo may have given a reduced profile to the imposition of all of this, but that's a temporary deal for sure. And they will be able to bring it back at will, that full China model, if they choose to do so, if we don't do something about it in the meantime. You have written at Substack a very important piece. Again, I can't tell you how much I commend you for your courage in doing so, because you've looked afresh at one of the, I gather, sort of central tenets of your ideology in the past, namely that guns in the hands of citizens were a bad thing and should be removed. And that would take care of gun violence across the country. You've rethought it. You talk about your very personal experiences with it, your husband's, you know, help in navigating through decisions about how to protect yourself and your family. Just talk very quickly about how you've come to understand both the founders' vision and the Second Amendment, for that matter, as part of protecting us from this sort of tyranny.
Yeah, it definitely was an evolution for me, Frank, because, you know, as you said, I'm the daughter of San Francisco hippies and bohemians. And, you know, in the 60s and 70s, when I was growing up, guns were considered passé and tacky and unnecessary. And on the left, you know, definitely there's no sense that people, law-abiding people, need guns, right? They're like, you're a lunatic if you've got a gun, or you like shooting. And guns are seen as very, very dangerous innately. So there's a great effort toward supporting removing guns. Well, I have had an evolution, and I do go into it. It wasn't all at once, but I have been looking around at the last 2 years at these great democracies where the rights and freedoms, indeed the written rights and freedoms, the Charter of Rights, you know, European treaties on human rights, they were just switched off. You know, parliaments were just sent home. You know, quarantine camps were just built, and people were locked in their homes, you know, on the China model, as you say. Like turning off a light so easily. And the only reason that we in America are relatively more free and more democratic, still lowercase d, than Australia or Canada or New Zealand or Britain, you know, in parts of Europe, is because of the Second Amendment. And there's no way around it. And also activists and our brilliant founders, prescience in creating a state system where, you know, Texas and Florida can stay free even if you lose New York and California, hopefully temporarily. So I also of course, like a lot of people, changed my mind about guns when I shot a gun, you know, and was trained to fire a weapon and got
and
used
it was
to-
your own personal security that was on the line. Naomi, alas, we are hard out of time. I wish we had another day with you, but I hope you'll come back to us again soon. Such a vitally important conversation on so many different levels. The book, again, is The Bodies of Others. Read it, commit it to memory, and go forth and multiply in practicing the lessons that Naomi Wolf is teaching. God bless you, my dear, and we'll look forward to a further visit with you soon. Next up, a representative from the state of Louisiana who's taken on the Chinese Communist Party. That and more straight ahead.
Night after night, in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa: Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa: Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back, and a very special welcome to our next guest. His name is Representative Chuck Owens. He is a member of the House of Representatives in Louisiana. He has, to his credit, taken point on what I hope will become a national initiative. It certainly is required at the state level as well as at the federal level. And we're going to talk with him a bit about the Chinese Communist Party, the threat that he believes it represents, as do I, to our country, to our people, to our freedoms, and why he has taken an initiative now adopted by both the House and Senate in Louisiana to warn of that danger and urge corrective action on the part of our country. Representative Owens, it's terrific to have you with us, sir. Thank you so much for joining us and for your leadership in this respect. Tell us about it.
Well, thank you for having me, Mr. Gaffney. It's an honor to be with you and to meet you.
Thank you. The honor is mine, truly. So what was the thrust of this legislative initiative? Tell us where it stands at the moment. And the thinking that went into its adoption by you and your colleagues.
Well, I am I'm a third year lawmaker in Louisiana. I am I'm a first termer. I'm a retired military officer, native here in Louisiana. I was going through some old legislation last summer, and I became aware that in the 60s, the good people of the state of Louisiana had identified the USSR as the primary enemy of the United States and the people of Louisiana. And they went to great lengths to specify why we were concerned with the Soviets in those days. Some of the law turned out to be bad law. There were some association tests and things like that that were very much old think in the 60s and are gone now. With the Soviet Union gone, it occurred to me no one has stood up and said this type of thing against our current set of enemies. And it's not always a state feeling thing to do, but I said, you know, it was done before. There's no reason not to. So I crafted a similar piece of legislation as opposed to a law. We've done a concurrent resolution that basically identifies the Chinese Communist Party and the People's Republic of China as the primary, most imminent threat to the United States of America and the state of Louisiana. And the resolution asks the president and the Congress to take positive, proactive action to defend us from what they're up to. The resolution speaks of the atrocities that go on inside of China. I made the point from the floor of the House that what they do inside their borders is their business, but it needs to be spoken in public how cruel they are, how poorly they treat people of all types. I spoke of what they're doing to Uyghurs. I spoke of how they treat people of color, how they treat homosexuals, just the terrible things that go on inside of China as a bellwether saying, this is who they are. And they're exporting this type of thing around the world. I drill down in the document about their predatory trade practices, how they infiltrate universities, how they infiltrate government. And I spoke on the floor about how if a company is in business with a company, if a U.S. company is in business with a company from China, then all their data is shared with CCP. And this is dangerous. It is dangerous on so many fronts, and nobody wants to talk about it. I am told, and I have heard, that there are a lot of American elected officials who are beholden to those folks. I'm not one of them at all. And so I think it needs to be spoken because, Frank, you and I are old enough to remember how dangerous the Soviet Union was. And we're also old enough to remember when the Soviet Union fell, some well-meaning, even Republicans thought, well, peace is going to break out. Things are going to be okay. So we started to disarm, and we've disarmed significantly over the last 30 years. When I went into the Air Force in 1986, we had 650,000 people. I think they have 300 now. The Army went from 20 divisions down to about 8. We are disarmed, and the Chinese have been building over decades, and they are a looming threat that we need to be prepared for on many fronts.
Well, you couldn't be more right about all of that, it seems to me. And I'm always of the mind that any country that treats its own people this horribly is not going to be terribly kind towards us or anybody else for that matter. And that's certainly true of the Chinese. As you say, they're exporting, among other things, their whole social credit system, data-enabled oppressive technique, and it's the China model. And some of that is here now as a result of all the COVID business. And it's a very, very ominous portent of things to come. I think it's absolutely true. I wanted to come back to something you touched on, though, that we addressed in a webinar from our Committee on the Present Danger China yesterday. And I want to commend it to our audience. Video of it should be up, I would guess, in the next day or so at presentdangerchina.org. It was about elite capture. It was about the phenomenon of what the Chinese have done to inexorably get their sort of claws into elites of various kinds, academics, yes, the Hollywood types, yes, media personalities, yes, but especially business leaders, and now an awful lot of politicians as well, it becomes clear. And so I'm struck, you know, it took somebody like yourself with a military background and appreciation of just how serious this threat is on so many different levels. It's really unrestricted warfare in practice. It's what they call it in China. And the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party, is the force behind it all. So when you look at this and the kind of response you got from your colleagues, I guess it's heartening that you did not find an awful lot of elite captured individuals in the Louisiana legislature willing to stand up and resist this. Did you, in fact, run into more of that opposition than you've suggested so far, or just got below the radar?
I didn't run into any, so I don't know if they just don't know who I am or don't care. When I brought this bill to the floor of the House, this resolution, one of my colleagues asked me a question. He said, okay, I get what you're doing. He said, but if the Chinese go into Taiwan, do you think the United States should be involved? And, of course, that's always the weird, ambiguous question. And my response to him is, we need to be responsive to anyone we have a defense agreement with. And I know that's a gray zone there. And then it bleeds over into the question of Russia-Ukraine about who we're obliged to. I am not an isolationist, but I am a person who believes in living by his word. So if we have an obligation to someone, that's one thing. But that was the only pushback I got. I was told that I would get pushback from business leaders because a lot of business goes on here in Louisiana with the Red Chinese. We have a lot of back and forth agreements with them. We buy a lot from them. We sell a lot to them. But no one said a word to me about it. So which puzzles me. Like I said, it may be because I'm a first termer and maybe they don't want to take me seriously. But the words have been spoken. The document is being readied, and the Secretary of State is going to transmit this to Washington in the near future. So the words are now out there.
Well, and more importantly, in a way, the model for other legislators around the country to do the same is now out there. And maybe it's the fact that it's a resolution and it's not binding and it won't compel action by the state is a clever finesse that would, you know, reduce the resistance that you might otherwise have gotten. But it sounds to me as though it's a very, very sensible and long overdue, as you say, response to an enemy that is, if anything, vastly more dangerous than the Soviet Union was back in the day. And you mentioned, you know, the resolutions that this is modeled after. If that were needed for the Soviets, it's vastly more needed in this case, I think.
It is. The level and the type of their threat is so much more dynamic than the Soviets. I mean, the Soviets were literally coming at us with hammers. They had the massive nuclear arsenal. They had the massive army. But they did not have the finesse of the Chinese in terms of being able to infiltrate important elements of our society. The Soviets fell because they went bankrupt. The Chinese have seen this and they have done something else. They have this state-sponsored capitalism that lures people in who need and or want the money. And that's what people told me I was going to get pushback from, was from the business people who are so in love with this money that the Chinese give them. And I didn't get that question. And quite frankly, I don't want their money if it comes with any strings. No one in the United States should want their money if it comes with any strings. You know, you mentioned earlier, Mr. Gaffney, about the social credit scores. I mean, that is obviously going on here. It is going on in a surreptitious way through social media, and there's discussions of it happening elsewhere. We need to stand firm and speak of it now.
Amen. Well, let me just say that, you know, as you look at this sort of agenda, it's no accident, comrade, as the Soviets used to say, that the Chinese took away from, not just the bankruptcy of the Soviet Union, but how it was brought about. And that was by my old boss, Ronald Reagan, who very deliberately set about cutting off their cash flow. And the Chinese, under Deng Xiaoping, made it a priority to integrate with our economy in so many different ways, to elite capture, yes, but also just create these codependencies that would make that exceedingly difficult for us to do again. And so while I think disengagement is definitely the order of the day, we're not seeing it as one of the things that's in prospect at the moment. Representative Owens, I am so appreciative of your leadership on this effort and want to thank you for taking point on it, something we expect of our military personnel always. God bless you, sir, and keep up the great work. Come back to us, if you would, with updates on how it's going there in Louisiana and as we take this effort, hopefully nationwide. We'll be right back with more right after a very brief commercial message that helps make this program possible. Stay tuned. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The primetime launch last night by the House Select Committee on January 6th showed that it's promoting a false narrative of a government-toppling insurrection, not pursuing the truth. After all, the truth is there would have been no penetration of the Capitol had it been on a heightened security status. Instead, somebody directed that it be on a less secure footing than even the normal day-to-day level. Who gave that order? Was it the same person who declined President Trump's authorization to deploy 20,000 National Guardsmen to protect the Capitol? The further question occurs, was the reason for such decisions to set the stage for direct action, perhaps by FBI informants and operatives and those with whom they were working? We're not likely to get answers to these questions from the January 6th committee, at least until it's under new management. This is Frank Affney. Back, and it's always a delight to be able to say, as we're going to turn to matters involving our most vital interests, particularly in the military space, but more generally, strategically, especially in the Far East, that we have in the House virtually our friend and colleague at the Center for Security Policy, one of our senior fellows, Colonel John Mills, United States Army retired. John has a distinguished career in uniform as a special operator specializing in psychological warfare operations. He has also served his country as a civilian in senior positions in the Office of the Secretary of Defense and National Security Council and elsewhere. He is a great resource. We're always delighted to be able to pick his brains. He's a member of our Committee on the Present Danger, China, and an outsized contributor to its very important work. John, it's good to have you back. Welcome, sir.
Good morning, Frank. Always an honor to be with you.
Thank you. Let me ask you about something that is unfolding as we speak. The Chinese Communist Party has called for an urgent, I think even an emergency meeting with the Secretary of Defense, who is now out in Singapore. Talk a little bit about that meeting, what you anticipate it would entail, and whether the Secretary of Defense should, in fact, take the meeting on the sort of notice that he's been given, which is negligible.
Yes, thank you, Frank. Under the first term of the Trump administration, they wouldn't have taken this meeting, or they would have exacted significant concessions. Yes, the Shangri-La dialogue is going on. Everybody just go to the webpage. It shows the agenda. This is not secret or classified. This is a regular gathering of the senior defense secretaries or ministers. What is extremely unusual is a late-breaking request for face-to-face. And having gone to Singapore 11 times, the trip out there is brutal. They're 12 hours ahead of us right now on the East Coast. And it takes you a good 72 to 96 hours to even recover from the trip and the time zone change and be lucid and be effective. So they're catching effectively the whole team in a foggy state. And I can assure you all the 05s, 06s, and 07 on the travel team are flailing away, negotiating with the Chinese counterparts who effectively have no jet lag and no are not in a foggy state, and working to negotiate terms, conditions, and topics for the agenda. And everybody's flailing away with three hole punches and notebooks. Now, Austin's speech is Saturday. Wei's speech is Sunday. I'm sure they're trying to get to Austin before he gives his speech to rattle him, shake him up, and exact some kind of silly comment. The team needs to stand their ground, and I'm not going to name names on the travel team, but they need to stand their ground and give Austin the right kind of professional, apolitical advice, and they need to stiff arm the Chinese Defense Ministry and tell them not so fast there, Uyghur concentration camp breath. This is just unacceptable. And they should be setting the agenda, not the Chinese. And in any way they adapt or conform to the Chinese, they're just giving in.
John, you're the first person that I recall who made a very unsettling observation. And that was that on the eve of the Japanese attack against Pearl Harbor in 1941, there was a similar request for an urgent and emergency meeting. I think it was in Washington at that time. Why would you make that observation? Do you think that we may well be on the eve of a similar kind of attack by the Chinese?
Yes, Frank. I mean, in World War I, they called it whoever executed the railway timeway table first would win, which led to that incredible catastrophic tragedy and catastrophe of the First World War. In many ways, it's a similar situation today, and the Chinese are under immense food pressure, energy pressure. And Xi has to demonstrate results, or somebody in his inner circle just might decide to retire him and demonstrate results. He has to demonstrate whether it be enveloping, attacking Taiwan. I mean, the war has already got started in the Pacific. It's a silent war. The absolute hapless and feckless behavior of the Blinken State Department in just handing the playing table to the Chinese. This is willful, intentional destruction of American interests. And the Chinese have already essentially flanked us on our left through the Solomons. And now we got, you know, another incredible failure. The Cambodians, who I'm sure would have been happy to deal with America if they could find an American, we've essentially just handed Cambodia to the Chinese in the South China Seas areas. And now China has a new naval base. Unbelievable. But this is the deep staters. And the globalists at State Department, combined with Blinken, just essentially handing playing piece and after playing piece to the Chinese intentionally.
Yeah. John, we have to take a short break here in a moment, but just to pick up on that thought, I don't think we've spoken since Tony Blinken made his speech, his much ballyhooed statement of policy about China. And it sounded as though it could have been plucked from, you know, 20 years ago, where everything was cast in the context of, well, competition at best, and a lot of cooperation, particularly on the great existential threat of climate change, for example. And what we're looking at now, it seems, is just further evidence of how out of touch that is and how much it must be emboldening the Chinese Communist Party, as they calculate what they will be able to get away with in terms of, well, the envelopment, as you say, of Taiwan, its reduction, perhaps assaults on other U.S. interests and assets in the region. We're going to talk with John Mills a bit more about all of that and our supply chain dependencies and what they portend on the other side of this very short commercial message. We'll be right back with Colonel John Mills, United States Army retired. Straight ahead. We're back, and we're continuing our conversation with John Mills, United States Army retired colonel, a man we've turned to again and again for insights on, well, a whole host of issues, but particularly about developments in the Far East. And John, you sort of threw in a laundry list of challenges we're facing there, not just the increasing assertiveness of China towards Taiwan and operations around it, as well as through its airspace. But we're also seeing them flanking us in the South Pacific, in the Solomon Islands. Cambodia, I think the Chinese have been deeply involved with the Cambodians for a long time, but they're you know, obviously taking chips off the table at the moment by opening up a new naval facility. But this is really of a piece with what they've been doing around the world, isn't it? With their Belt and Road Initiative, creating infrastructure that can turn into power projection capabilities if they want to. In short, what we're looking at, John, it seems to me, is a China that is increasingly confident that they are ascendant and going to be able, should they choose to do so, to use military force decisively. And if they can win without fighting, as Sun Tzu taught, they'll do that. And I think probably they're more and more confident that that will be the case too. Your thoughts?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the leading edge of American, asserting American national interests, America First interest, should be State Department. And they've shown to be just totally passed out drunk in the gutter on almost every topic, too busy chattering in the faculty lounge at Foggy Bottom and other places, bemoaning Trump and, you know, America, and sometimes openly to foreign partners, which I've seen and just about felt like throttling or punching them in the face. You know, at the the gathering of the Conference of the Americas in Los Angeles, okay, I will give them credit. They kept out three of the worst of Central and South America. I think it was Nicaragua, Venezuela, and Cuba. Okay, good for them, because there was some weak-kneed moments that looked like they were going to bring them in. Now, Mexico decided to boycott, whoop-de-doo. But they've all of a sudden discovered that China and Russia are in Central and South America. Newsflash, you know, Secretary Pompeo, who was incredible at State Department and really began to flex some State Department muscle, they knew about that years ago and were starting to take action. So this is pathetic. The Chinese are on the move. They've run out of liquidity and cash. One of the reasons they've departed the Los Angeles movie scene, and Top Gun was actually pretty good and reinstated the Japanese and the Taiwan flag. But they're on the move, and it's our State Department that either needs to spend more time in the gym and start acting like a State Department, or just get out of the way, because they're you know, just worthless. And
John, I wanted to ask you about one other piece of this Taiwan scenario. And I think we may have a little bit of a disagreement about it, so I'm fascinated with your thoughts. We've been told, partly thanks to the legacy of the Kuomintang, which really had departed dramatically from Chiang Kai-shek's anti-communist traditions, to become essentially in Taiwan the party of rapprochement with China, engagement, and ultimately, I think, probably submission. There is a perception that there's potentially a large, well, for want of a better term, fifth column in Taiwan that would make China's designs on the place that much easier to achieve. Your thoughts on whether that's real or whether that problem has been actually taken care of by the Taiwanese?
Well, President Tsai, the Taiwan National Security Council, and the Taiwan legislative body have been very effective at shutting down. It's not perfect. There's still little green men out there, but the lifeblood of little green men is cash. It's called walking around money. That's influence money. And in December of 19, and I had kind of dropped a big hint with some folks that that was critical to shut down the little green man situation. They passed a new law and arrested a number of KMT supporters who were on the take. And, you know, Han Ko, who also a lot of pictures of him hanging around with Ted Lieu guy of California. The KMT was notoriously corrupt. I mean, and Chiang Kai-shek would kowtow to anybody who handed him cash as opposed to his wife, Lady Chiang. My great uncle spent 3 years marching around China with Chiang Kai-shek. He was notoriously dirty. But the best way to shut down the little green man situation, and I've worked this around the world, you got to shut off the cash supply. That's what keeps it going. No cash. Really minimizes the little green man. I'm not saying it's perfect.
John, let me ask you quickly. We've got less than a minute. There is a report out of China that an economist there is arguing that China should somehow seize the TSMC chip manufacturing capabilities. I have no idea how that would be accomplished, but it is an indication of their interest in that supply chain. Talk very quickly, if you would, about what's at stake there.
Yeah, TSMC, the dominant chip maker in the world, I can't explain it. It's something in the water. They can do it. Everybody else struggles, including us. They've driven it down from 5 to 3 and dropping it further nanometers, the quality of these chips. And it is a driver in the world supply chain. I'm trying to buy a new car right now. It is a total circus and freak show of dysfunction. Thank you, Brandon. But a lot of this is driven by the chip things, and the Chinese need it for their own weapon systems.
Right. And they will get it, I'm afraid. John Mills, we have to leave it at that for the moment. So much more to talk with you about. We'll look forward to doing so again next week, I hope. In the meantime, thank you for your service to our country, past and ongoing, now with the Center for Security Policy. God bless you, my friend. Thank you to the rest of you for being with us for this edition of Securing America. I hope you feel better equipped to help us in protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic. Check out our website, securingamerica.tv, for more on what you can do. And in the meantime, I hope you'll go forth and multiply.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.